I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Tamler Summers, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Houston. We're discussing his 2018 book, Why Honor Matters, from Basic Books. Summers works on ethics, political philosophy, and the philosophy of law, specializing in issues related to free will, moral responsibility, punishments, and revenge. He is the author of Relative Justice from Princeton University Press, among many other books and articles, and is the co-host of the Very Bad Wizards podcast. First of all, Tamler Summers, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
So, Tamler, I enjoyed the book. It's a spirited and often very funny case for honor in our world where we're all too ready to abandon honor. I wanted to ask you first. I usually ask people first about the motivation for writing the book. So maybe you could say a little bit about it. On your other podcast, you talked about the triggering cause for it, that Paul Bloom suggested it to you. But I know from, because I know you, we're friends, that you've been interested in the concept of honor for a while. So how did you get interested in that concept in the first place?
Yeah, so I was did my PhD, and my dissertation was on free will and moral responsibility and the evolution of attitudes that are associated with responsibility and blame. And the evolution of attitudes like resentment and outrage and gratitude. And this was my first job at the University of Minnesota Morris. A colleague named Steve Burke said, in my work, I wasn't paying enough attention to culture and the evolution of cultural norms. And so I asked for some recommendations, and he gave me this book, Culture of Honor, by Nisbet and Cohen. And, you know, it's a fantastic book that is about why an honor culture exists more in the American Southeast than in other parts of the United States. And what this led me to more research in anthropology and sociology on honor. And at that time, I was really concerned with what I saw as significant variation in how they understood responsibility, in contrast to how more individualistic cultures, non-honor cultures, understood responsibility. In our culture, we have a strong emphasis on the idea of individual control as a necessary condition for responsibility. And so it seems unfair to blame somebody if they had no control over the action, the wrong or immoral action. And in honor cultures, what I found was that although they distinguish between intentional and unintentional actions and acts that we had control over and acts that we don't have control over, there's less of an emphasis on that. And you can be held responsible for unintentional actions or the actions of a member of your group. So there's collective responsibility, collective punishment in honor cultures. Coming here to University of Houston, I get to teach that great books course. And so we read the Iliad and the Odyssey and the plays. And you see there also that people take great pride in actions that, and their credit, they're given great credit for actions that are performed essentially by the gods. They're vessels for what the gods do. And yet people don't think that takes away from the credit they deserve, or when the gods make them do bad things, the blame that they deserve. They'll try to appeal to that as an excuse, but usually the excuse is dismissed. So anyway, this is probably a longer answer than you were hoping for, but this led to my academic book, Relative Justice, and which argued that there were significant differences across cultures in attitudes about responsibility. And then I started to get interested in honor for its own sake. And this is, you know, what you're referring to. We've known each other a long time. Part of that is being immersed in the ancient Greek honor culture, and just learning more and more about the various norms and values. And I found myself drawn to many of honor-related values or virtues, I think in part because they often are values or virtues that we find lacking in an individualistic culture like the United States. So values of courage, solidarity, community, these are hospitality. Eventually led me to propose, with the help of Paul Bloom, as he said, a book written for a wider audience, giving a qualified defense of honor.
Yeah, good. And it's great. It's very persuasive, and it's an important concept. I've worked on honor too, and I think it's important to make a case for it in our culture. So
Hegel and honor is
So I've worked on a little bit on Hegel, who has the German term is Standesehre. So it's just like the honor in one's estate or the community that one belongs to. Sometimes it's translated as esprit de corps. Mm-hmm. The Germans were interested in this. And I mean, I'll ask you about this a little bit later, because I think, you know, some of the more the progressive movement, you could say broadly in the modern age, I think tries to combine honor and dignity in a certain way. So that's one of the things I'm interested in asking about a little bit later. But yeah, so some of this stuff I'm interested in. Let me back up to ask you just in general what you mean by honor, which I guess, since it's as you say in the book, it's a kind of ambiguous concept. So maybe you could say a little bit about what it means and use a lot of examples here, so feel free to use those.
Yeah, so I mean, it's such a messy concept, and that's been hard. I mean, as I say in the book, I've been working on this project for 4 or 5 years, and I've been interested in it for longer than that, and I'm still hard-pressed to give this a concise account of what honor is exactly. I mean, at a very basic level, your honor is your value or worth to the larger honor community or honor group. And that value is both your perceived value and also your actual value to that group. So, you know, an easy way of understanding this is someone, Tom Brady has a lot of honor precisely because he is so valuable to the Patriots, and they recognize that he is valuable, and he also is valuable. He does contribute to their success and their victories. So honor is something that you have to earn through contributing to the good of the group, through observing the norms of the group, and not transgressing the norms of the group. I think it's helpful to distinguish more honor-oriented cultures from non-honor cultures, sometimes called dignity cultures. That's a recent term, I think, that was originated with the sociologist Peter Berger. Honor cultures, people in honor cultures tend to have a heightened concern for their reputation. Their reputation is closely tied to their honor. And so, while we all care to some extent about how we're perceived within our community, there's a greater concern in honor cultures. And then along with that comes a heightened sensitivity to insult and to challenges, because people are often competing for honor within an honor community, and challenges or insults can be a way to move up in the honor hierarchy. And so in honor cultures, you find this strong conviction that you can't, that you have to stand up to challenges. And if you don't, that can signal weakness and it can lead you to be dishonored. You find, I think, greater the importance in honor cultures on characteristics like courage and loyalty, solidarity, and this real strong conviction that people should handle their own business, both within the community, if there is a conflict, that people should sort them out themselves. And there is a resistance in honor cultures to outside interference, impartial third parties interfering in how you handle your own conflicts. Mm-hmm. So that's about the best I can do. Yeah. It's not great.
It's
embarrassing. I feel shame for not being able to give a better sort of analysis of it. But, you know, I do my best in chapter one of the book.
Yeah. Do honor to you there. That was good. Just to return to where you started, it's interesting you talk about honor or lodge at least in a certain kind of value to the community. At least when I think first and foremost about honor, it strikes me as a kind of status concept, right? So it's related to a certain rank or rank ordering that, I think about it as associated with aristocratic cultures, and maybe you have a different sort of archetype of an honor culture than what I have in mind.
In practice, I think honor cultures tend to be a lot more egalitarian mm-hmm. than non-honor cultures. And some of the practices that we associate with honor, like dueling, for example, were opposed on the grounds that they were obstacles to creating a more stratified hierarchy mm-hmm. within the community. To go a little deeper into the specifics, there are two dimensions of honor that an anthropologist named Frank Stewart distinguished between. There is horizontal honor, and this is the honor you get just in virtue of belonging to a particular honor community, like, say, the aristocracy, or to a football team or a hockey team, or to the Navy SEALs, whatever the community is, or you're a judge, and you just get the honor that's associated with that, and people have to treat you in a certain way because you belong to that community. So that he called horizontal honor. And then there is vertical honor. And vertical honor is the honor that people within the community compete for. And this, it requires a level playing field, at least within the honor community, so that your achievements and your contributions to the groups will be what determines how much vertical honor you get within that community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found that to be an interesting distinction of the book. In part because I think of honor as connected to a certain kind of, what you call like a functionalist view of community, where different people occupy different like functional roles in a community. And so in virtue of occupying some kind of functional role, they have this horizontal view of honor. But they also, in virtue of the fact that they have to perform a certain function or telos, right, the better or worse that they do, then they can get more honor or less honor or shame if they fail to live up to their station, right?
Right. And, so one of the examples I return to a lot are hockey teams. And on hockey teams, the degree to which you are successful in fulfilling your role for the team, it determines how much honor and respect you have from within the team culture. So obviously an enforcer, their job is not to score goals. Their job is to be intimidating, to stand up for their teammates, make sure that their more skilled scorers aren't the victim of a bunch of cheap shots. And so to the extent that they do that, they can be just as honored or valued, even if they get much less time on the ice and mm-hmm. even if they never score a goal all season, because they're fulfilling their mm-hmm. role. Mm-hmm. So like you said, it's not that everybody's competing to do the same thing, but everybody is competing to do the job or the role that best suits that group.
Yeah, I mean, and this is one of the things that I'm interested in about honor in this sense is because, I mean, one might say, to use your term, like an honor culture has much more differentiation or diversity, like to use that term, in the sense there are a lot of different kinds of jobs or roles or functions, whereas the alternative is much more homogenized, where you have individuals who choose their own path in society. It's not clear what the paths are, right? Honor cultures have the sort of differentiated roles that you play. You know, there are set paths, set functions that you can sort of plug yourself into.
Yeah, and there's good and bad
things
to that. This is this great short essay. It's called Peter Berger. It's by Peter Berger, the sociologist who just died, and it's called "On the Obsolescence of a Culture of Honor." And what he distinguishes honor and honor cultures and non-honor cultures in part by the way that people in honor cultures constitute their identity. Yeah. And in an honor culture, your identity is constituted by a given role. Now, there can be a lot of flexibility or less flexibility, but that's how you see yourself, in part by your role, whether you're a man or a woman, or you belong to this family or that family. That's part of who you are in an honor culture and how well you perform the role that people assign to that class or group within the community. That's how that gives you your purpose or your telos, as you say. And then in non-honor or dignity cultures, these things like, you know, your sex or your what family you belong to or the job that's, you know, like if you're a farmer, the jobs that your family expect you to take on, they are viewed as masks or like a veil that conceal who you are. They don't reveal who you are. They're not part of who you are. They're things you have to work through in order to find out what your real purpose is and what your real identity is. And again, especially in restrictive honor cultures, there's a lot of benefit in granting people more autonomy to determine what it is that they truly value and what it is that they truly want to do with their lives. But without any direction, you find in dignity cultures, and this is something Berger was attuned to even in when he wrote the paper in, I think, 1970. Is it that early? I'm not exactly sure on the date, but it might even be more true right now, a kind of an alienation, a feeling of disconnect between you and the larger world. People aren't sure how they fit in anymore. And that can be, with all that extra freedom, comes some costs, too.
And so everybody identifies themselves as an outsider. Mm-hmm. So everybody plays the role of an outsider. And so whole society is homogenized in their alienation of it. So, yeah, I mean, so it's fair enough. I asked you a second ago about the point about status and rank, because part of what I wanted to get at before we get into like the costs and burdens of honor is to ask you what you think the basis of honor is, or why we desire honor. So, I mean, because one option is you think about, at least one way this might go is to think, well, we want honor because we want to be better than someone else, right? So we want to be a member of the aristocratic community because we're not like the plebs, right? So we get this sort of badge and you wear a fancy uniform. And you have to perform certain kinds of duties and virtues and you're motivated to do that because you don't want to slip down and be like shamed as being like the pleb. So, I mean, that's one way, although I suspect you don't want to go in that direction. I mean, why in your view, like, what is it about human beings that motivate us to honor? Because it seems weird, right? Because you have a duel and it's like you're staking your life, which is, you know, fundamental human desire, the fear of death. And so it seems to go against our natural desire. So it's kind of weird to think about where it would come from.
Well, in one sense it is. And in another sense, I think people in honor cultures are more willing to risk their lives in defense of their honor than people in non-honor cultures. It's not the case that, you know, your odds of making it to adulthood are really low. But I think here's a need that human beings have that is almost as fundamental as the desire to survive, which is a desire to be respected and to have the respect of the community that they belong to. Just to use myself as an example, I'll always remember, I feel like this was maybe the most important moment of my career. And ironically, it was a talk that I gave on honor cultures. It was called The Two Faces of Revenge, Moral Responsibility and the Culture of Honor. And this was just when I was getting started with this research and applying it to moral responsibility. And I gave it at this conference, the Society for Philosophy and Psychology, which was the biggest moral psychology conference, which is area that I was working in. And the talk went over really, really well. And the difference in how people were treating me after I gave that talk, and that really continued throughout my career, I was really blessed to have that happen fairly early, was so remarkable. It made my life just happier, less stressful, better. And there's a lot of psychological research that tie respect or the status that you are treated within your profession or within your community has strong ties to happiness, and lack of that has strong ties, or perceived lack of that, to depression and also suicide. So I do think we have this drive, and I'm sure there are evolutionary reasons for this and cultural reasons for this, to have that respect. And I think honor is just an even more heightened concern for that. But it's a very powerful, this is why one of the big cases for honor that I make is how powerful a motivational tool honor can be to get us to go above and beyond the call of duty. And I think what drives that is this desire to be perceived and valued by the people that we respect and the group that we belong to.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's almost as if there's like two baskets of desires, right? The desires that surround honor, desire for respect or recognition. And those often go in contrast with the sort of, I don't know, we'll call it more material desires. I mean, because I said earlier, yes, you have to stake your life, but you don't always have to stake your life, but you have to stake lots of other things, right? Sometimes you have to sacrifice money or material gain for your reputation. So, I mean, it's not easy. And so these things are, I mean, so it's not surprising. We use Plato or the ancient Greek model as an example. I mean, Plato had envisioned this distinction within the soul between the our desire for time and then the more appetitive types of desires, precisely because he recognized the sort of distinction and the tension that exists.
And he recognized how powerful a motivational part of the soul it was. And, you know, he, of course, thought it had to be under the control of reason for it to lead us to good actions. But he certainly placed it in a higher category than just the, you know, desires for material gain or pleasure.
Right. Yeah, it made me wonder, because I think you ultimately think that honor has to be contained. I wonder if you're a secret Platonist after all, right? I mean, did you imagine that this three tripartite soul? I mean, would you put human desires in that sort of tripartite way?
That's a really interesting question that popped into my head probably exactly when it popped into your head. Because I've always thought of myself not as a Platonist, or at least not as a Platonist in the way that Plato is thought to, the view that is often attributed to him. I'm not sure that he necessarily had that view. I do think honor needs to be contained. Where I would probably jump off board from Plato is that I don't think reason is exclusively the thing that needs to contain it. And I would have, the chariot doesn't work for me because I think sometimes your honor has to overcome your reason. Because that will lead you to perform the virtuous action while your reason will maybe recommend a more pragmatic course. And I certainly am mildly repelled by what I see as a kind of hyper-rationalist emphasis in philosophy and to some extent in the larger culture. Although I recognize and I benefit from what they have done, there's something that I find just unappealing about the technocrat, the technocratic liberal. And I think part of that is this just relentless belief that the only thing that matters is being rational. And without even a really strong understanding of how they would derive some of the conclusions that they think are so obviously the ones that reason would lead us to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you talk about honor and you talk about honor cultures in the book. I wanted to maybe before we get into like the virtues and vices of honor, just ask you a little bit more about honor culture. I was mainly interested in what you thought about that kind of classification of honor culture versus non-honor culture, dignity culture, because it strikes me that there are relevant differences among different kinds of honor cultures. Because I think about, the different examples used in the book, sometimes you use very ancient examples from ancient Greece. It can even go further back to sort of traditionalist or tribal societies. But you also use examples from the present, which I think of as kind of like little platoon, like Edmund Burke type of local community type examples. But then there are also types of examples from like aristocratic Europe, which is very, like a very different kind of society than the ancient world. And even sometimes you use examples, like sporting examples, where you share honor with strangers. Like that wouldn't be in the tribal society, you would know everyone, but in a kind of sports example, although this doesn't apply to the sports teams, but so sometimes in some of the cultures there, it's strangers versus fellows. Some cultures there's great inequality, like in the aristocratic culture versus a tribal culture that's much more egalitarian. So I just don't know if you had a view about whether these differences are important, or are there different ways to think through the communal instantiation of honor, where there's a better and worse types of community where honor can be instantiated?
So I have put a lot of thought into what makes an honor culture a well-functioning honor culture. I don't know if I thought about it in terms of the different structure, or at least not in any significant detail, the different sort of possible structures that an honor culture can have. I do think that relatively egalitarian honor cultures tend to be the ones that are most well-functioning. But there's also a lot of other things, like having elders that have the respect of the community, that can guide people, that can restrain the passions of the younger generation. I mean, and again, in that sense, this is a little like back to the Plato analogy. The elders can serve that role as charioteer, sort of guiding the spirit of the younger communities. And sometimes when honor cultures go bad, it's because they lack those elders and they lack that voice that can moderate some of the passions that you find just in younger people, and especially younger people in honor cultures. I definitely would want to give more thought. One thing I didn't really examine in detail in the book is the sort of 17th and 18th century aristocracy in Europe. I talk a little bit about feudalism, but that's comes a little earlier. And then I talk about dueling, but that example is it's really more within the aristocracy, which the dueling practice is trying to maintain at least rough equality within. Yeah. Within that group, but I haven't thought about it, and certainly one of the, I think a fair criticism of the book could center on that example, because even with something like dueling, if you don't belong to the aristocracy, then you don't have the right to challenge a person to a duel and restore yourself to their level. And there is a strong exclusion that is in some ways built into that honor-based aristocracy of people who just weren't fortunate enough to be born to that. And that is something that's, I think, is deeply unfair and deeply unfortunate. And, you know, it's definitely one of the constraints that I would want to have is not necessarily that everybody can belong to an honor culture, but that, you know, nobody is excluded just in virtue of their birth.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I think through your examples and the way that you develop it, it strikes me that you have something of an ancient concept, pagan conception of honor in the following sense that, like, you know, so when I think about honor, I think about the aristocratic societies of Europe, and I think about the way in which, you know, all the problems that, like, early modern thinkers saw with that kind of society and the need that, you know, hence the need for a sort of dignity society to arise. And,
yeah.
I mean, I think of this also in the context of, you know, so Nietzsche's genealogy of morals. I don't know if you think about Nietzsche at all. Context to this, but
I haven't, but I think I should.
So he has concepted, like, there's the master morality, and that's the honor society, that's the honor culture,
right?
And so, well, what emerges is out of that inequality, because of this inequality that you talked about a second ago, there's a deep kind of resentment because these people can't belong to the honor culture, so they, you know, they develop a certain, you know, an early form of dignity, essentially, that all human beings have this kind of moral responsibility and so forth, that equality of the human race that seeks to combat that view. Anyway, I mean, I just think about this in the context of, it strikes me that what you're looking for is something like kind of an older, before the development of, you know, the strong forms of inequality that started to take over.
Yeah, although, you know, Tocqueville, who I also don't really talk about enough in the book, but he saw, I think, promise in an American version of honor precisely because it didn't have this rigid class structure that Europe had. And so there is a part of early America and, you know, all the way up to maybe to the end of the 19th century that also has that kind of quality. You know, it's also the time of duels, of course, and but there are the barriers to break into the higher status positions are not nearly as impregnable.
Yeah. Okay. So this gets into the, I think, like, at the very beginning, I mentioned that I think some of these 19th century thinkers try to combine something like honor and dignity. And I think of Tocqueville as someone who tries to do that, right?
Yeah.
He has a chapter in Democracy in America on honor and democratic societies. And yeah, so that I could see that as a way to go, is that the way that a lot of these 19th century thinkers took it is that you can derive a certain kind of honor through participation in certain kinds of social and political associations, like like having skin in the game, like having a certain role to play in a sort of egalitarian, you know, community. That seems right.
And your obstacles may be greater because of your background. I mean, surely they're going to be, but at least it's possible. And that's sort of the promise of America, and it's sort of now, I think, the thing that people feel, and with a lot of reason, that we've lost, is now the barriers are too high to overcome. Whereas, you know, again, this wasn't obviously true for people who were brought here as slaves, but there wasn't this class structure among non-slaves that imposed this, I guess these obstacles that you really couldn't overcome in virtue of your birth. I just saw Hamilton. Did you see it?
No, I haven't seen it. I'd love to.
You know, and his story, I think, is a celebration of exactly that aspect of America.
Yeah, that seems right. I mean, that brings up to the present where. I mean, I think one of the common themes, it seems, is the amount, you could say, in thinking about the structures where honor can flourish, is the structures in which one can have a certain kind of agency in the fate of the community. Or I think originally what you said before, that you have a certain kind of value to the community. Right? Yeah. We have a bunch of... We live in a society where almost nobody has any agency over the levers of power. And then on the other hand, we have these enormous, impersonal... online communities or otherwise that people then feel like they have to push even harder to achieve honor. You get these sort of like, I don't know, toxic forms of honor, I guess, that gets us.
But without, I mean, the problem with that is, I think that's such a, if it is an honor culture, it's such a corrupt version of it, because people don't really know each other and you don't really take any risks when you challenge people, insult them, and so much of it is anonymous, either literally anonymous because they're not putting their real name, or anonymous in that we don't know who that person is. So when anybody takes a shot at me on Twitter, it's like, I don't know, and I don't really care, because I don't know the person.
Right. Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, that's helpful. I mean, in a way, I guess what I'm asking you about is a sort of social scientific question, right? It's like, what are the institutions that push towards a healthy honor culture rather than a corrupt honor culture? And these are the sort of...
And I think, you know, some of the best examples of military units are healthy, can be healthy honor cultures. And honor culture, I've had a lot of former military email me about the book. And one that I just got said what he didn't notice until he heard my conversation with Sam Harris was he was overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan and had been raised in the honor community of the Army and was very familiar with the tribes that he was stationed near and interacting with, but never made the connection of how a lot of their codes and values, how similar they were. And I think, you know, sports teams, any kind of situation where you have a built-in form of containment so that the norms... of the community have certain limits on how honor is allocated, and also a threat of escalating violence that they can keep. If there's an institution in place that can keep a lid on that, then that is often a place where a flourishing honor culture can grow within a larger nation that may be. It has turned its back on honor, at least officially.
So let's turn to talk about the virtues and vices of honor, which comprises the meat of the book. You're talking about the virtues of solidarity, hospitality, accountability. On the virtue side, maybe we'll start there with thinking through the virtues. Maybe we'll just pick out a couple of the virtues that you think that honor and honor cultures cultivate, and so what are the advantages? What's the case to be made for honor?
Well, I'll pick one example that I talk about in the book in chapter 3, the community. So one just natural thing that can happen that can make people all of a sudden become much more drawn to honor related values is after a tragedy of some kind. And the example I use is in Boston, which has kind of a small town feel at the Boston Marathon bombing. After the bombing, there was this big lockdown of the city as one of the culprits was still at large. But then Big Poppy, David Ortiz, the hero, like one of the three or four most famous Boston sports heroes in my lifetime, but probably in any sports fan's lifetime, he gave that speech, which I'm sure almost everybody has heard at some point, where he says, "This is our fucking city, and nobody's going to take away our freedom, and stay strong," he said. I'm getting like chills. I'm like tearing up just describing it badly as I'm doing. But it was such a galvanizing moment for Boston, and it led people to contribute so much to the community of people who were harmed, the amputees. People were visiting hospitals, raising money. And then the next year, they had the highest number of entrants into the Boston Marathon ever, with so many people just running as benefits to help the victims of that crime. And I think so. What David Ortiz in this just brilliant and so heartfelt and I'm sure spontaneous 2-minute speech was, he appealed to the honor of Boston, you know, and the people. He's saying, we're going to stick together and we're not going to be afraid anymore. We're not going to be afraid of, you know, this 19-year-old kid who's running around. We're not going to shut down the city. And we're going to come together and we're going to recover from this. And that kind of solidarity, which unfortunately it sometimes takes a tragedy to inspire, but I that's something that's so valuable, and that you even find people are happier after some sort of natural disaster or tragedy, because it brings these honor associated virtues out of them. They're all of a sudden interacting with people and they're helping people and they're trying to contribute to the community, whereas before they were just living their own individual lives. So I think one thing that honor cultures are really good at is inspiring that sense of community and solidarity that just connects people. Everything about the modern world tends to provides incentives for us to get more and more isolated. Even just the fact that, you know, like a job like we have, you know, we live where the job is. We don't live where our friends are, where we grew up. Or I don't know, you didn't grow up in Houston, did you? Yeah. So all these things are trying to disconnect us from the communities that we had. And honor cultures are good at bringing that back. So that's one.
Yeah,
I think,
so let me, just before you go on to the next one, I'm going to ask you about that. Because, I mean, so what about, I mean, maybe this is an obvious objection to that, which is, what about the dark side of generating a sense of communal solidarity, of course, is that it sometimes generates a kind of in-group out-group reaction. So I mean, the example you use is a difficult one because maybe it's just the case of this one or two brothers, but you know, you might also think about what George W. Bush and Patriot Act, it's after September 11th. You know, there's a great sense of honor that developed there, but there's also, you know, a way in which hate crimes are on the increase. There's general sort of anti-Islamic sentiment that develops as a result of, I mean, so that, at least the one thing to be said for an individualistic liberal society of indifference is that there's not as much hate that exists, right? So how do you think about that?
So, I mean, this can be a problem, and it is a problem in many honor cultures, is a kind of out-group hostility that can lead to deeply immoral behavior. This is one of the things that I think would need to be contained. I think in general, there needs to be this kind of respect for human rights that grew out of this dignity culture. And that is, I think, the major triumph of Enlightenment values and the Enlightenment way of thinking. So how do you contain it is, I think, a tough question, and it requires, I think in some honor cultures, it's just not considered acceptable to behave in those manners. So they have internal constraints. It would be considered dishonorable to commit anything like a hate crime or even a lesser act of a lesser immoral act. But sometimes I think the constraints do have to come from external to the honor group. If the norm, I mean, this is the sort of broader fundamental problem. If the norms of the honor culture are bad, if the norms that determine what actions get honored and what actions get shamed, if those norms are bad, then the motivational power of honor frameworks becomes a bad thing rather than a good thing. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be a way to contain it. And if you can't contain it, then I would say we have to get rid of it in the way that people like Steven Pinker and others believe. But I think it can be contained. It often is contained. There are a lot of examples of that. And so that's what we should look to be doing, is figuring out how to limit that destructive side without sacrificing the benefits that come with a greater sense of community and solidarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this is interesting. I mean, because it leads to, I guess, two different sets of issues. I mean, the one hand is the, I guess you could say, the level of the moral question or the principal question, like, what are the moral limits of an honor culture? At what point did the principles of dignity step in, right? And you may say, well, if an honor culture violates the rights of human beings, human rights or something, so the limit is the sort of principle of human rights. That's sort of one set of questions, the moral question. But I guess the other set of question is the sort of sociological or institutional question about how exactly does it work? What are the mechanisms for limiting an honor culture? Will, you know, the UN stepping in and saying, hey, let's protect human rights, guys, actually do anything to limit an honor culture?
Yeah, I mean, and I think it just depends what the context is, right? So if you're talking about a sports team, there are just these structural elements built in that constrain any kind of deeply immoral behavior, and there's no... and so that's taken care of as we haven't talked about this yet, but this movement Restorative Justice is a movement that I think has great promise as a way of handling conflict and handling conflict in schools, in juvenile courts, and ultimately in the criminal justice system. And again, there the built-in containment would come from people who are mediating the conflict and from whoever is in charge of enforcing and keeping the resolutions within reasonable limits. And then, you know, but in... you know, the Pashtun tribes of Pakistan or Afghanistan, you don't really have those kinds of institutions in place. And in those cases, well, it will depend, you know, but there's going to be good things, you know, them defending the Marcus Luttrell from Lone Survivor, you know, them defending him against the Taliban because of their commitment to hospitality and because their honor culture inspires them to great acts of courage, but then also terrible things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ultimate in some tribes, honor killings, for example. And in those cases, yes, somewhere, someone has to step in. The nation, law enforcement in the nation, or the UN. But there's a lot of flexibility there, and it really will always depend on what honor culture you're talking about, mm-hmm. what the context is. You
talk about accountability too is one of the sort of virtues that honor cultures promote. So what? How does honor culture promote that, and how, you know, as we've lost it, we've lost the sense of accountability?
Well, I think this is related to this heightened concern for reputation. So if your reputation is based on your actions and your value to the group, then there's going to be a greater emphasis on accountability, taking responsibility for what you've done, in both the backward sense and the forward sense. And when you lose that sense of, when you stop caring how people perceive you or within the community, then that, I think naturally this sense of accountability will go down, and you'll be looking for excuses for bad behavior, immoral behavior, everywhere you can find them. The sort of example I use in the book is that kid who he was drunk driving and killed four teenagers, and then his lawyer pled that he suffered from affluenza, which was widely mocked within the media, but actually it's very consistent with both philosophical understandings of when someone's responsible and when they're not. And that's just something in an honor culture, you have to stand for what you did, and you have to reckon with what you did. People expect that of you, and you expect that of yourself. I was reading this book on the hockey honor code, and it was remarkable how much just that word accountability, how central that was to the whole elaborate unwritten code of the hockey world. Mm-hmm. And I think it's tied to this accountability and this concern for how you're viewed by your teammates and other players is so important. So that's where I think it comes from.
Yeah, and I mean, that's interesting because it fits in with your previous work on responsibility. And
yes.
It's interesting because, I mean, to say when you do something wrong, right, and you're tempted to, I mean, this is in a way, as you say, it's difficult, I think, for liberal individualists to sort of wrap their heads around. Because you do something wrong, maybe it's partially the responsibility of somebody else. It's easy to sort of blame somebody else. But there's something, I don't know, you say empowering or agency granting, if you claim responsibility for something that maybe you weren't entirely responsible for, right? It in a way affirms your functional role or affirms your importance or value to society in taking responsibility for.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I didn't think of it that way, but I think that's right. And I think we all have experiences with both sides of that. Mm-hmm. When we have looked to shift the blame, and then when we have just taken responsibility. Again, whether it's technically something we had great control over or not, it does often, when you do it, not only does it feel like the right thing to do, but I think people appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And they appreciate it, I think, precisely because, okay, that means that this person can be counted on maybe in the future. And it's, I think, appreciated because it just seems like a part of a good character. The other example I use is Oedipus. And, I mean, if anybody had reason to let themselves off the hook for what he did. It was Oedipus. He had no way of knowing that that was his mother and that was his father, and it was fated to happen. But he still, once he discovered what he did, blinded himself in shame and disgrace in that way. Now, this might not be a healthy form of accountability, but I bring it up because in Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being, he compares Oedipus to some of the people in Czechoslovakia who collaborated with the Soviets, which led to the country being taken over, and now try to let themselves off the hook by claiming they had no way of knowing the atrocities that the Soviets were committing. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, the character in the book says, I mean, how can you do this? How can you not blind yourself or tear out your eyes because of what you've done? Why are you looking to shift the responsibility? Why aren't you claiming it? How can you do that? And this was something I talked about in my earlier work. As you said, there seems something really admirable about that attitude, even if, as you say, it's also seems counterintuitive, hard to wrap your head around from this individualist perspective.
Yeah. Make the case once again for Kant and Hegel for mm-hmm. Tamler, who's not a fan of Kant and Hegel.
Well, Hegel, I just don't understand.
But they have something like this view about responsibility, which for them is connected to the idea of living up to what it means to be a human being, as opposed to, disavowing responsibility. You make yourself into something like another object in nature or an animal in nature, right?
So, right. Yes. So that's a Kantian kind of idea.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, well.
So I get that, yeah. It's just, I think, I fully admit that I'm probably unfair to Kant.
But before you go on, I mean, that's, I think, for them, the connection between honor and dignity is that for them, we gain honor and virtue as living up to our humanity.
Yes.
Right. As opposed to dropping down and being an animal. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say that I think I'm probably unfair to Kant. I haven't read enough about him to have such strong opinions as I do, but that's just my nature, is to talk out of my ass. I should be a little more cautious, or at least informed. But what I don't like about Kant, this is the thing I rebel against, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, is that it's still all too abstract. Mm. So he's really talking about, you know, in virtue of being a human or a rational agent, that's the thing that's supposed to motivate you to claim responsibility. And it doesn't seem like those are the kinds of mechanisms that actually get people to take responsibility.
Yeah.
And so you really do need a more of a kind of a human and community oriented framework in place to get people to do this in practice rather than just in theory.
Yeah. Yeah. So he has a view of honor, and he talks about honor a lot. It's true that he thinks the true form of honor is living in accordance with our rational nature, as abstract as it is. But he does think that there are these sort of lesser forms of honor that can be useful in shaping our character such that we become more prepared or further along the ladder, you know, the developmental process toward. So he's not...
He's an early Kohlberg.
That's right. There is that element to it. I mean, but that I think is overlooked because, I think there's an impression about Kant that it's just, you know, like you have to bootstrap your way up to rationality from nothing. But he is aware of these sort of these lower forms, but he is skeptical of them at the same time. So he has a lot of critical things to say about dueling and other aristocratic forms of honor because they precisely can lead us in the direction to violate the moral nature of the humanity and other people. So, so anyway, but that's all to say, well, I do this basically every time I see Tamler, which is I recommend Kant or Hegel.
And people, you're not the first person to say that Kant had actually a lot more ambivalence about honor than I might think, because I associate him so strongly with this kind of rationalist, individualist perspective. Yeah. But and even have suggested passages to me, and I'm immune to the charms of especially his ethics, and I get very frustrated also by, and this isn't his fault, the contemporary proponents of his view.
Fair enough. Okay we could go on about that, but I'll
another time,
myself.
Another podcast.
You talk briefly about the vices of honor, because you do. This is something we talked briefly before this about the Atlantic ran a review of Tamler's book, and I thought it was unfair because it pointed out that there are all these problems with honor. Tamler, you admit them.
It even said earlier in the review that I don't hesitate to point out the problems with honor. And then at the end he says, but then he has an idealized picture of honor.
Right.
That was the thing I was so angry about and so tempted to take to Twitter about, but I restrained myself.
Good for you. So are you going to pick out one or two of the problems? I mean, one obvious one that comes to mind is the role of women, say, in honor cultures, or sort of pushed into certain kinds of roles that again reflect this inequality that I talked about before. But any of you want to bring up?
Yeah, I mean, so the broad problem, and then I'll go get more specific. Is this? There's nothing within honor itself as a framework that determines the content of the norms that will, I mentioned this before, but the norms that determine how honor is allocated. And so if what brings you honor in a community is an action that we would consider deeply immoral, then that's a real problem. And in particular, what brings you shame is something that we would not feel is shameful. And so this leads in some, but by no means all, honor cultures to a heightened concern with female purity, should we say. And I think you find this in extreme versions in the honor killing example, but also you find this in some Latin American cultures, where I think there's research that domestic violence is more tolerated, especially if the woman is suspected of going outside the relationship or the marriage. You know, this was something that I found deeply troubling in the book. I was heartened by the fact that certainly not on all honor cultures. I think in the Greeks had a healthy respect for women, even though their roles were different. But I don't think you can read the Odyssey and think people didn't have respect for women. And the plays often, the heroines are the ones with the most agency, who are driving the action. The whole Oresteia and Electra, you know, these are strong women with a lot of character and agency. And also the saga Iceland. This is something that I defer to William Ian Miller, but he said they didn't care if women slept around, and the women's were the ones that were really driving the men to perform acts of courage, and often shaming them when they wouldn't. So I was heartened by that, and also something that Anthony Appiah told me, who also wrote a great book called Code of Honor. What he says is, it's not surprising that you look around at honor cultures and you will find this heightened concern with female purity, because whenever there is in a culture, there is a need to do something that's really difficult to do. Honor, because of its motivational power, people will turn to that kind of framework. This is why warrior cultures, military cultures tend to be honor cultures, because it has to inspire people to risk their lives in defense of their unit or their group. And then you also find this in cultures that care about controlling female sexuality. Honor, because it works so well, it's so effective at motivating people, can do that too. Now, in one case, we think that this is heroic behavior. In another case, we think it's abhorrent behavior. And so honor is, in some sense, for better or for worse, a kind of neutral way of getting people to perform actions that are difficult to inspire.
Yeah, I mean, interesting thing. It's been a while since I read Appiah's book, but one of the interesting things about his point is that you can use honor then to correct honor, right?
Yes.
There's just like an internal correction. Like, you know, again, with the, to use the female purity example, you say, you know, the way to correct sort of wife beating, I mean, you could bring in dignity, which is one method. But the other method is to say, you're not a real man if you beat your wife.
That's right. And a lot of honor cultures have that. Yeah. Samurai cultures, that's one of their codes, is you can't ever hit your wife. You're a coward if you hit your wife. Another example that he uses that's a broader in scale is ending foot binding in China.
Yeah, right.
Rather than appealing to the violation, and it certainly was a violation of human rights, that practice, because it was very painful and led, you know, really crippled the women in those cultures. What they appealed to is how ridiculous and shameful they look in the eyes of the rest of the world. People that they wanted to have contact with and that they wanted to respect them, they couldn't respect them while this practice was still going on. And so that was, he has a whole chapter about how they appealed to this kind of honor, shame framework as a way of reforming a practice that may have been inspired itself by honor-related concerns.
So let's talk about violence and revenge.
Yeah.
Some of the little, like, more bloody parts of your book. I think it's tougher going, the argument here, because you're making a case that violence and revenge are not always bad, right?
Yes.
So virtuous aspects. So maybe bring out, because this is something I think that many, I mean, certainly, again, when dignity culture were very averse to these sorts of things. So, you know, like, make a case for why we might not think so, you know, unconditional, that violence and revenge are unconditionally bad.
Well, so one of the things that, first of all, I have a hard time with this question, because I don't believe that people already don't agree with me, given how drawn they are to revenge stories and how drawn they've always been to revenge stories.
Action movies. I mean, this is...
Yeah. Now, part of that is cartoonish, but part of it, I think... So, you know, you take an ancient story like Electra, and, you know, the version that I talk about is... Sophocles' version. So Electra's story, really briefly, is she feels bound to avenge her father's death at the hands of Clytemnestra, who killed him when he returned home from the Trojan War, along with her lover, Aegisthus. Now, Clytemnestra's reasons for doing that related to an earlier daughter's death. But setting that aside, Electra really felt that she had to avenge her father, and that it was shameful for her and Orestes, who had been exiled, not to have done it already. In Sophocles' version, she has a sister named Chrysothemis, if I'm pronouncing that right, who, it's fascinating. She has a very modern, pragmatic view of the situation. Elektra has been banished from the palace because she's constantly berating her mother and protesting Aegisthus, her lover's kingdom. And Chrysothemis just says, look, don't fuss. You're just a woman. You can't carry this out yourself. Why suffer so much when we could be living in the palace? And at least, yes, it's I don't like them either, but at least we'll have some of the pleasures of life. And if we try to get revenge, we'll just be killed. So there's no point in what you're doing. So she represents a really pragmatic perspective, and Elektra, and they have these great debates where Elektra, how can you say that? How can you not feel disgraced? Do you care about your father at all? Like, by doing this, we are demonstrating our love for our father and our sense that that the family has been dishonored by this usurper to the throne. And then when Orestes comes back and they get revenge, you know, they're taking great risks. They're risking their lives. And this is often the case with revenge, that people risk their lives to avenge somebody that they loved or somebody that they were close to or some member of their community. And so when people say revenge is selfish, it is precisely the opposite of selfish. You're risking your physical safety and comfort and sacrificing the material pleasures that life has to offer in order to demonstrate your outrage or your loyalty to a particular person that you're avenging. And if it's yourself, to demonstrating a kind of self-respect, a respect that you have for yourself. And so I think that's what we're drawn to in revenge. And while revenge can certainly go wrong in practice, I think the idea that, I use the example in True Grit, that story too, where Maddie hires a bounty hunter but goes along with the bounty hunter, again risking her life and her safety to avenge her father's death. It would be nowhere near as virtuous for her to have stayed back in her Arkansas town and just hired a killer to go out and bring him back, right? I mean, then she's not demonstrating any kind of attachment to her father. But by doing that, you can't doubt how much she loved her father. In spite of how kind of cold and unemotional she seems throughout the book and movie, you can't. Her act of revenge is the very thing that constitutes her solidarity with her family and her dad.
Yeah, good. Yeah, so strikes me there, I guess, you know, two alternatives that one could turn to from revenge, right? Because and you talk about in the book about, you know, you admit, you know, that there are these problems with revenge, that it begets a cycle of revenge and greater bloodshed. So the alternatives, though, are on the one hand the appeal to law, right, and to the state to put the to alienate the right to execute the law of nature, like John Locke's term. When you enter into civil society, you don't, like, you're not judge, jury, and executioner, you give it to the state. I'll talk about that in a second. The other option, though, which you don't talk about in the book, and I wanted to ask you about, because I was surprised you didn't talk about it. I think you've talked about this maybe in papers here that you've given here, but forgiveness as another alternative. So, I mean, maybe one question is, why didn't you talk about forgiveness in this context as a different option? And I guess the second point is just to make a case for forgiveness. I mean, this is kind of a return to the, like, Nietzsche paradigm, right? If you think about the master morality is characterized by honor culture and revenge, and slave morality as this as a sort of dignity culture in the idea of forgiveness that's built into that. And I take it the idea in forgiveness is not to be, like a worm that you can be stomped on, like, forgive you. But it's actually to put yourself above the fray, right? That you're actually claiming more honor than the so-called honorable people who are just killing one another constantly. That you are so great of a human being that you're able to set aside your tremendous desire to seek revenge.
Yeah.
And that you demonstrate your honor as a human being. And so what do you think about forgiveness in that context?
Well, I think there are good and bad kinds of forgiveness. I think there is a kind of forgiveness that is related or associated with just not caring enough about what happened. And that would, I think, would be a bad kind of forgiveness. Martha Nussbaum talks about the when the it's an Elie Wiesel speech that she heard or something that he wrote where he was a prisoner in a concentration camp and that was finally liberated by the American soldiers. And the American soldiers, when they saw the conditions of the people there, the look of just hatred and rage in their face, he says, that was the first step for me to reclaim my humanity, is seeing how outraged they were. And if they had just forgiven the people running the concentration camp, he wouldn't have felt that. And it would have, I think, demonstrated just an insufficient kind of emotional reaction to what occurred. Even in the case of forgiveness being used to sort of place yourself above the person, again, I think that can be good in certain cases, but it can also be sometimes getting revenge is almost like an act of respect. And when you fail to do it, now you could call this, maybe this isn't true forgiveness, but it's almost because you think they're just beneath you. I think this happens in academia, you know, if somebody writes a critique of your paper or who takes a shot at you in some concept and you just shrug it off, often, I think that's just because you don't think they rise to the level. You're a little like those duelists who just says, no, you can't duel me. I don't care. Right. You haven't rose to the level where I feel like I have to retaliate, you know? So
maybe being above the fray or above the people isn't the right kind of metaphor. I think maybe what I have in mind in thinking about forgiveness is the way in which, you know, it's certainly in the Christian tradition, you think about how forgiveness is about recognizing your own role in the crime, right? Yeah. That you yourself are responsible for the sins of humanity. I mean, that's the way that you're sort of like the Brothers Karamazov, when you talk about the, who's the one carried the priest and the carry. Anyway, it talks about the, you know, how each one of us carries the way that's original sin and so forth. So putting one side, so it's not right to say in that case when you take on the sins of others, sort of Christ model, it's not to say you put yourself above, Christ doesn't put himself above others, but he sort of arrests the conflict that's always implicit in revenge, right? Revenge always has implicit the tendency for counterstrike, because neither side recognizes the justice of the other side. And so forgiveness at least provides a kind of model for incorporating both within a broader community, right?
Yeah, so there is a good kind of forgiveness, and I'm not going to, I won't speak to the Christian element of it because I just don't know anything about that. But it's something I talk about in the book in restorative justice. One outcome of a restorative process can be a kind of forgiveness and a deep sense of forgiveness. And I think that is both beautiful and very consistent with principles of honor, because in those cases, the parties, the relevant parties, the people who are engaged in the conflict, the offender, the victim, they have met and they have connected and they have sorted out why. And sometimes this can lead, as you say, to the victim feeling like, you know, I'm part of you know, say you've been assaulted by somebody who lives in a really poor neighborhood, you know, that you can sort of understand why they did what they did. And if they are taking responsibility for that, and you still feel this sense that you, as far as you're concerned, you no longer feel like you're, that person needs to suffer anymore for what they've done, and that comes through this honest, real connection, then I think that's great. And that can, that's an outcome that might not be as fun to see movies about or, you know, read books about, but is something that I think is maybe not frequent enough in our lives, but I think can be an outcome that is deeply honorable, yeah, in the way you say.
I think, I guess I, just as another side, is sort of remember when I was growing up watching a lot of these action movies, and it strikes me when the good guy gets the bad guy at the end, say in the 1980s, the outcome wasn't that the good guy would shoot the bad guy in the head, right? The outcome was almost always either forgiveness or, more frequently, you know, you're going to be taken and justice is going to be done by the law rather than the... Whereas now, I'm going to just see what your reaction is to this and contemporary culture. I mean, it's just sort of like Tarantino-ified everything. That movies now, the good guy shoots the bad guy in the head, and that's the sort of outcome of conflict. I mean, I think of Tarantino's recent movies...
So Django Unchained, maybe, or yeah,
or the one about the Nazis, but
yeah, Inglourious Bastards. Yeah. Well, so
I don't
in
know
both
if
cases, the sort of the level of evil that they are battling makes it hard to hard not to feel a certain degree of satisfaction,
sure, yeah,
when the violent acts. But I think, you know, if you look at Kill Bill, there's a more nuanced view of revenge as something that maybe has to happen, but not necessarily because the people are bad people, mm-hmm, who have to be the targets of it. And I think, you know, I'd say my favorite movie, I have two favorite revenge movies, and they both take a very complex analysis of revenge. So one is Unforgiven, mm-hmm, and you know, that's an ending, the ending of Unforgiven, where he shoots Gene Hackman, Little Bill. It has to happen. He has to show loyalty to his friend Morgan Freeman, who Gene Hackman tortured and killed, but there is also a sense that he's destroying his soul in the, by doing that, and it has a kind of tragic or almost nihilistic element to it. It has to happen, but there's no real purpose or victory here. And then the other one is a movie that almost nobody has seen, but is so phenomenally good. It's by the director of Old Boy, Chan Wook Park, and Old Boy is the second movie in this revenge trilogy. The first movie is called Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and it is a story of a man who sets out to avenge his daughter's death, but his daughter's death was in some sense an accident. People kidnapped his daughter, and there are very understandable reasons why they did that, and actually treated her very well, and it was just the fact that the man was deaf that led to her death. And the man knows that he has to kill this guy, but also knows that he's a good person, and in some sense does it, it's wrong that he should die for this. And it's that sort of conflict. So I think revenge, this is why these stories are so fascinating. It's not cut and dry. It's not like this is clearly a bad thing or this is clearly a good thing. It's often a, there's a competing values, yeah, at, yeah, stake. Yeah. And one of them has can't be fulfilled.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just add the Western, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is very good suggestion of the same kind of conflict, although it takes in this sort of conflict between revenge and the law.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know who needs the last others. It's the John Wayne characters. Out here, we take care of our own conflicts, right? And Jimmy Stewart's response to that is, you're no different than Liberty Valance when you say that, right? Yeah. You're perpetuating this cycle of revenge, which is a crime that begets a crime and begets a crime. And so, I guess I want to sort of, get to the point about the law or the state to think about the law, and because you're skeptical, I think, of the role of the state and sort of intervening into conflicts between two different parties, and that it's, that essentially understanding crimes as crimes against the state rather than crimes against the other person. But, in one way I was thinking about that and thinking about the dignity tradition, it might not be... The state doesn't seem to be primarily a crime against the state, at least, say, for somebody like Locke. But it's a violation of the rights of another individual. But it's the state that's the only one who actually can render an impartial verdict. And so I think the satisfaction that people say, like the Jimmy Stewart character takes in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, is that we can appeal to this kind of impartial sense of justice, like justice is done. Right? When we ourselves carry out, are the vigilante that carries it out, there might be a lingering sense of doubt. I mean, maybe it's not true for the extreme examples, where it's clear evil that's out there in the world, but all too often in life, there aren't those kinds of examples. It's much more unclear who's clearly at fault. That's why you need an impartial judge.
Yeah, so I'm very skeptical of that view, in part because... I think nobody has provided a remotely compelling system or argument that would determine what impartial justice is in a given case. So I'm skeptical of it at the level of theory. If you look at the sort of implicit retributivism that governs U.S. criminal law, this idea that you have to give criminals punishments that are proportionate to their culpability, and culpability is determined by the severity of the crime and also their level of blameworthiness. It's just there's nothing even close to a non-question-begging argument for how that matching up of culpability to punishment is supposed to be. Nor do I think, even if somebody could do that, that it would be the overriding or exclusive concern of justice to bring it about. So that's one reason why I'm skeptical. I'm also deeply skeptical, as I assume most people are, about how this is implemented in practice. The idea that justice is implemented impartially without concern for the wealth or the race of particular criminals. I mean, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be laughable. So what I try to promote in the book is an approach to punishment, an approach to justice that recognizes that when an offender commits a crime against the victim, that they have committed the crime against that victim, and that therefore the victim ought to have some voice or influence in what the outcome is. And right now, in principle, the victim is... their voice is completely excluded because it's not considered relevant to the criminal's culpability. And that's what should, in theory, determine the punishment. Again, that doesn't work, but that's the idea. And so by design, the victim's voice is excluded. And I just think that's not how we want to handle conflicts in our everyday life. And I don't see why we would want to have it to handle it this way when a law is violated. Now, you know, the great thing about restorative justice is that it allows you to some extent, when it works well, to have the best of both worlds here. So on the one hand, you bring the victim back in, you recognize that the goal of justice is not to give the criminal some illusory idea of the just punishment that matches his culpability, but rather to resolve this conflict in a way that is satisfying both to the victim and to the offender. And it allows you to observe certain boundaries and limits that will bring not a full impartiality to the proceedings, because I don't think that's desirable nor possible, but a level of we can't go outside of these boundaries. And so if there were racial bias within a restorative process, there would be ways of addressing that, because this is controlled and this is mediated by judicial officials. So what that allows is to address, I think, some of the deep problems with people having overreacting or thinking that a certain punishment, you know, wanting to be too vindictive or perhaps even too forgiving for a punishment in a way that would really diminish the interests of the state. But it also allows victims and offenders to connect and for victims to recover some element of what they have lost when the crime was committed against them, both in terms of just restitution, but also in terms of a sense of empowerment that often comes through these processes. There just is this empowering feeling. This is true when you're a kid, and this is true when you're an adult, in standing up for yourself and not letting other people fight your battles for you, and really showing up and looking a person who may have assaulted you or harmed you in some way in the eye, and coming to some sort of terms where the offender has to recognize your humanity. And so, you know, it requires a reformulation of how we think about justice, but I think one that is long overdue, even if we just say it's for practical reasons, like this has led in practice to mass incarceration and an indefensible racial imbalance, at the level of schools, the zero tolerance policies have led to suspensions and the school to prison pipeline, all of that is just whatever the reasons for it, I think both at a philosophical level and at a practical level, we should introduce this approach when we can.
Yeah. Well, that's a tantalizing road to go down, but we're pretty much out of time. So for you, when you write your next book on restorative justice, which I expect.
That is exactly what I intend to do, yes.
Okay, good. So we can't quit, though, before I ask you this question, which I take it is, in a way, probably the question that you get the most, certainly implicit in the Atlantic Monthly review of your book, which is thinking about the kind of the why now question for this book, which is in the contemporary political landscape that we find ourselves, where we find ourselves in a kind of polarized country in which there's a lot of statements of honor, or at least like moral grandstanding, that this honor that is maybe claimed, it might be responsible for some of the ills that we see in society. And so maybe the idea is for us that we need less honor, not more.
Yeah, so I happened to be writing the epilogue of the book, or this was right before I had to turn in the book, and this happened right after Charlottesville, the march there that was truly, I think, eye-opening for a lot of people. I think we were already divested of the illusion that we were living in a post-racial society, but the level of certain attitudes, the degree, it was so, it was shocking. It was appalling. And so I'm doing the little research about some of these people and the people they're inspired by, and people like Richard Spencer. And the thing that made me quite uncomfortable was seeing that some of their rhetoric had some sort of connection to some of the arguments that I was making. So they also talk about an atomized society and a growing sense of isolation and a lack of and an alienation. And those were some of the things that I bemoaned too in an earlier chapter in the book. I'm grateful that, at least in the research that I did, they didn't use explicitly, they weren't talking about honor, but they were using a lot of the other related concerns. And I, of course, wanted to distance myself from that. I think, though, that, and this is something that pissed off when that guy in The Atlantic said that I wrote in a chastened spirit. I wasn't chastened. And in fact, I think that, number one, they can't be called an honor culture. White people, or even white Americans, is too diffuse and broad a group. And a real honor culture, people know each other. These people don't know each other. These people don't see each other as contributing or having value to a particular community. But I think the rise in this kind of alt-right sensibility also speaks to some of the real deficiencies of a dignity culture. This seething resentment, this alienation, this lack of social connection and communal connection. And so when you take that away from people, they will, it's a deep craving to have this sense of purpose and this sense of identity, belonging to something. If we want them to belong to something that is healthy and not something that is destructive. They're going to find this somewhere. Why not incorporate well-functioning and healthier forms of honor culture as a way of satisfying those needs? So that's my view on that. I think when people talk about polarized times and tribalism in America, this is very different than the tribalism of honor cultures. This is the last thing I'll say. Because we're polarized or tribal in the sense that we're identifying with an ideology or a political party, but not with actual people. Right, not with an actual community of people. And that's something that's essential to honor cultures, is you're not identifying or loyal to a party or a position or an ideology. It's this group of people right here that you know, and that they care about you. You care about them, and you want to earn their respect in a real, not abstract sense.
Yeah. Well, Talmud, it's been a great conversation. Thanks so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Yes, thank you for having me. This has been one of my favorites, if not my favorite, of these discussions. Maybe it's Hegel and Kant. I need to look into that.
That's right. We'll talk about Kant.
Listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us, and thanks to you for listening.